to the sixth presentation. This is the Parayana. This is the way beyond. It is related to the Mahayana, which was the great way, which was followed by the Vajrayana, which was the diamond way. But before there was a Mahayana, there was the way, and the way was Jesus. In the New Testament, he says several times, I am the way. And that way goes back in rhythms of time several thousand years. And in that several thousand years, it has punctuations that if one can read it right or hear it read out right, you can learn what the harmonic was and the scalar of the music of time. That time is a dynamis. The Greek word for it is dynamis. When time curls, it creates energy out of the dynamic, and energy always then, in terms of its calibrated frequency, will polarize what the dynamis flows with into phenomena, so that you will have an electromagnetic energy that becomes matter. And it will have dimensions in space, three spatial dimensions, which literally blossom by curling out of the flow of time, so that to understand the rhythms of time as the first dimension, you get the calibration by which you can then understand that there is periodicity in terms of phenomena, because space itself has a periodicity. The curling will produce leaves eventually off stems, and if the leaves curl even more, they will become flowers. So that flowers are a higher energy than leaves, and leaves are a higher energy than stems. And all of this is compressible into the seeds, the pollen of the flowers, so that there is a cycle. And what keeps that cycle cyclic is the tempo of the dynamis. Without knowing the dynamics of history, one has no way of understanding what things are and why they are. And when you do, the most incredible recalibration begins to happen, and it takes a while for this not to sink in. That's the wrong way to speak about it. It takes time for the laving of this to grow, and the ancient wisdom way of talking about this was, this is how a pearl is made. And so the pearl of wisdom is taking the time to let the laving of the recognition of time rhythms and phenomenal energy levels leafing out, blossoming out, reseeding themselves. One of the most peculiar aspects that we have been talking about is how from a special pivot, a whole flower of a new calibration of man went out from a pivot in Alexandria, classical Alexandria, about 2,000 years ago. And that pivot, when it reached out its stretch, its arms, the farthest that one arm went was to the Irish Sea. And the farthest that the other arm went was the Bay of Bengal. And so from Ireland to India was a single initial hug for a new calibration of map. And in that hug, all of the lands in between, all of the kingdoms spread over thousands and thousands of miles in between, achieved a recalibration so that they became, instead of disparate kingdoms, they began to have a lattice structure, and they began to have a quality that we today would call crystalline. That one can look with recalibrated eyes or hear with recalibrated ears the lattice structure of civilization and how and what it is, how it came to be, and where it is going now. And it is now going next in a huge way, very huge way. In the next 6 years, you will see a sea change, not only on the planet, but in our species. What is peculiar is that if we took these two disparate reaches from the Irish Sea to the Bay of Bengal, the Bay of Bengal is the farthest that one of the apostles went. His name was Thomas, St. Thomas. And St. Thomas had a cross made in India, and this was the cross that is displayed prominently in India over the first church that St. Thomas founded. And this illustration is from the ancient manuscript of Marco Polo. This is Sir Henry Ewell's translation of Marco Polo's travels. It's one of three volumes. It was just too huge to bring them all. Marco Polo not only went to China, but he also went to India. And one of the reasons he went to India is that Marco Polo, this is what Marco Polo looked like. Marco Polo was one of the greatest adventurers, soldiers of fortune of all time. He not only went with his relative all the way to China from Italy, they brought back spaghetti, among other things, but Marco Polo was one of the greatest sea captains of all time, even though they went over land all that way. But when he got to China under Kublai Khan, Kublai Khan found that Marco Polo was not only a great ship's captain, but he was understanding structure of fleets of ships like an admiral would be. And so Marco Polo was put in charge of the Chinese fleet. And in his time, the big trouble was that they could not do their maritime sailing easily through Indonesian waters because of pirates. So it was Marco Polo who cleared the pirates out of Indonesian waters and allowed then for not only Chinese trade to go through Indonesian waters to India, but in fact to go across the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean, all the way to Africa. For instance, an Indonesian gamelan instrument was taken by Chinese fleets following Marco Polo's pioneering and went to Africa, and it became the xylophone. And so one finds the African sense of rhythmic music is very much related to the kind of gamelan orchestra music that you would find in Indonesia, or in a curious way, the kind of Taoist cymbal clashing kind of music that is done with special esoteric performances. So all over the world, one finds peculiarities. If we come back to St. Thomas's cross, this cross reappears here in Los Angeles in 1925. And this is a reproduction of the cross. It's an esoteric Christian cross. It is the esoteric Christian cross of St. Thomas in India. And this was a cross made by the young Manly Hall, Manly P. Hall. And here's a photograph of Manly P. Hall when he was about 25 years old and one of the most remarkable teachers of all time. He was at, in his day, he was not only the head of world masonry, he was the head of all the esoteric branches that there are in the world. And he made this cross. This was framed, the photo and the reproduction, by the Mason order and given to me during Manly Hall's funeral here on Wilshire Boulevard at the old Masonic temple across from the concert hall near Lucerne and Wilshire. I was so taken with it, I asked them if they would frame my favorite photograph of Manly Hall in like framing, which they did. This is a photograph of Manly Hall. It's my favorite photograph of him. He is sitting, waiting for a portrait, while the female portraitist photographer is walking backwards, and just as she trips, and he's watching her fall gracefully, protecting the camera instead of herself, he has this beautiful smile on his face. The photographer was at the time the wife of a very old friend of mine, Dr. Stephen Heller, who was the Gnostic bishop in Los Angeles for many years. The interesting thing is that this cross is presented between two pillars that are linked by a curve arch. You find this same arch, which is in India, you find it in the west of England, at Nettleton, Wiltshire, and it is a great healing shrine there. It has maybe 30 buildings. The original building we talked about last week was an octagon building. It is a healing center and has been so for 2,000 years. It was called the Shrine of Apollo because the inscription that was ball-peamed into it was read as the Temple of Apollo, and it's simply somebody who doesn't know how to read and doesn't know the history. And the history is this. It is not a shrine of Apollo. It is a shrine that commemorates the fulfillment of Virgil's messianic eclogue, eclogue number 4. Virgil died in 19 BC, but he was always held to be a Christian prophet visionary because the fourth eclogue predicts the birth of a baby who would save the world and create a complete new age. The follower of that time, four-age time, was in the other Roman epic writer, Ovid, And if you look at Ovid's Metamorphosis at the beginning, he talks about the four ages of time for men. There's an age of gold, then an age of silver, then an age of bronze, and then it decays all the way down to an age of iron. And at the end of a brutal iron age comes a complete change to a new age of gold. And at the time of a new age of gold, there is something that is only seen every 500 years. A phoenix will be seen flying out of Arabia, flying to Egypt, flying to the site of the Temple of the Sun, Heliopolis. It has been there for more than 5,000 years. And at the Temple of Heliopolis, it will deposit the body of its dead predecessor into a flaming pedestal to purify it. And out of that fire will come the spirit of the old bird to come into the new bird. And the new energized, reincarnated phoenix then will be the visionary herald of the age of gold. That it always works this way. There are more than a dozen major Roman writers who write about the actual seeing of the phoenix in 36 AD. The most famous of them is the great Roman historian Tacitus, who was a Roman general. He was a Roman consul, governor of Asia. He is one of the world's great figures. He says there is no doubt that the phoenix was seen in Heliopolis in Egypt in 36 AD. The reason being is that Jesus was crucified and resurrected in 36 AD. As soon as that happened, not only did the apostles get sent out over a wide swath of the world, but all of the Holy Family, except just a few members, were sent out over the whole world. Jesus had four sisters. They were all married. He had four brothers. None of them were married. None of them ever had children. Three of the sisters had children. The oldest, named Salome, had two sons. They became St. James and St. John. One of the sisters, named Mary, for her mother, had a son, a single son, and he became St. Mark. Another sister, the youngest, Suzanne, the fourth sister was named Joanna. Susanna married one of the richest men in the world, Joseph of Arimathea, and they had two children. The first child that they had was before the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, and it was a daughter named Anna, because Anna runs in the family, just like John runs in the family, James runs in the family. This is Anna when she was buried at Nettleton on Wiltshire, when she died of old age in the first century AD. The inscription reads, in the time of Apol Decimus. The Decimus comes from the Latin decemvir. It means 10 men. And the decemvirs were the only legitimate readers of prophecy in the Roman Empire and Roman Republic times, going back to early Republican Rome. The city was founded about 750 BC. And in the time of King Numa, the prophecy was read only by certain men, and eventually it became the 10 men decemvirs. The decimus means this is someone who was authorized to read prophecy right, and read the prophecy of Apuleio, because Apuleio, as a Roman general and very famous man, mentioned by Virgil in his fourth Eclogue. If you look at the two pillars with the arch surrounding it, they are the same architectural notation. You will find that this repeated four times will make a structure that is the center of every cathedral in Christianity. It's called the Baldacchina in Italiano. And the baldachin goes over the altar of the cathedral. The earliest cathedral that has a baldachin is St. John Lateran in Rome. And St. John Lateran is the cathedral of the city of Rome. St. Peter's is the cathedral of the Roman Catholic Church in the world, but the city of Rome, its cathedral is St. John Lateran. And the baldachin is placed over the altar, and under the altar are the heads of Peter and Paul, encased in sculptures. The actual heads are encased there. And only the Pope may officiate at that altar in St. John Lateran. It is his personal confirmation that he is the Pope, that he is able to handle the tremendous energies, the psychic energies, the visionary, noetic energies that are focused there at this time. Now, this is a sketch, and the photograph of the actual implement is this. This was like a sculptural reproduction of what a face mask would be, a death mask. And this is Anna. She was the last living relative of Jesus. She was a niece of Jesus. And her shrine now has this architectural layout. And in my book, I will have all the documentation for all of this. Anna married a British king. His name was Bellemoir, M-A-W-R, like Bryn Mawr. King Bellemoir was the king of Cornwall. And his castle, traditionally, was in the place where the, and was the original for the castle 500 years later, a cycle of the Phoenix later, which became Camelot. So Jesus' niece, he had several nephews. Not only James and John and Mark were his nephews, but as it turns out, and we'll talk about later, St. Matthew and his brother St. James the Less were also cousins. So Jesus had five nephews and a niece, and the niece was the only one who was able to marry into a bloodline outside of the Hebrew heritage. Her child was named Penarden, and Penarden carried the female right to have the lineage of the transformed Hebrew lineage passed on now to people born in Britain. And not only Britain, but it was that part of Britain near Bristol, England, on where the Irish Sea and many of the estuaries are. So it's the west of Britain, it's Wales, it's Ireland, and it's southern Scotland. It's like a diamond shape all around the Irish Sea. Penarden married the most powerful, important man in that whole diamond, and he owned the massive fishing outfits. Jesus' family were always tied to fishermen, and he was known as the Fisher King. And his name, spelled in Welsh, is L-L-Y-R, In Irish, ancient Gaelic, L-E-R. In Scotland, it was spelled L-E-I-R, like my name, the I-R ending. And in Shakespeare, he is King Lear. But he is also the Grail King. Because along with the female heritage went the right to pass on the Grail. Because the original Grail came from the household that the sister Mary owned, and her husband was named Cleophas. And Cleophas and Mary owned the house where the Last Supper took place on the second floor in the great hall. And it was quite a large hall because they did not sit at a table. In those days, one reclined on couches with little serving places, and usually it was a young member, male member of the family who did the serving. And that young male member was the young John Mark who became St. Mark. He was about 9 years old at the Last Supper. He's the one who poured the wine into the Grail, from which then it was portioned out to cups. And he was the one that served the bread and served the Paschal Lamb. And so the young Saint Mark turns out to be a very interesting little boy. When all of the family, the Holy Family, went to England, which wasn't England yet, it wasn't even Britain, it was like a series of kingdoms, and in the west of Britain was where the highest civilization was. Because that is where Stonehenge and Avebury and many other structures in the Wiltshire Plain were descended from structures that were begun in Ireland going back almost to 4000 BC. And by 3200 BC, we're architecturally able to construct a dome, as we talked last week. It's called Newgrange. It was built about 3200 BC, which is interesting because it's exactly the time that the great Indian War is fought, the Mahabharata. It was fought about 3102 BC, about that same time. It's about the time that you begin to see the coalescing of Egypt into the two lands being one, Egypt, having a first pharaoh, having Narmer. It's about the same time that in China you begin to have the first beginnings under Fuxi and Nugua of what became the lineage of the great kings that eventually then became dynastic China. So all over this swath of the world, you find about 5,000 years ago a movement that coalesces about 3,000 BC. So that there is a time rhythm, as we started off, that moves by 500-year cycles that pair and then become a 1,000-year rhythm, a millennium, which pair, because pairing is a part of the process of enfolding and raising the complexity. And so two millennium together make an aeon. And two aeons together make a great tradition. So that if one is able to go back 2,000 years for an aeon, you will get a rhythm that will have a median punctuation of a millennium. So if you go from our time back to Jesus' time, it means that that 2,000 years is an aeon, and 1,000 years will be a special millennial point. And 500 years later will be a special cycle of the phoenix point. And one can go back from there, back from Jesus 2,000 years, and when you go 2,000 years back from Jesus, you come to Abraham, who was born about 2,000 BC. And if you go forward from Abraham, one millennium, you come to King David and King Solomon. And if you go 500 years from King David, you come to the return from the exile. And then 500 years further, you come to Jesus. So that if you're able to read rightly and you open a Bible to the New Testament, the very first thing in the New Testament is the Gospel of Matthew. And the very first thing that Matthew does, because he was masterful at detail and organizing things. He was not just a customs inspector. He was the head of the international trade dispersion from the coasts of the Mediterranean Sea, inland all the way up through the Euphrates and Tigris river valleys. And so he was in, and all the way down to the Red Sea. He was in charge of an enormous trade exchange of enormous extent. Matthew says these are the generations of Jesus, son of David, son of Abraham. So right away he gives you, this is the millennial read back. And if you read it right, it has another rhythm, time rhythm, another dynamic built into it, because it not only makes then a pair of 500-year cycles, which then are paired millennia for an aeon, but you can read the same time period in thirds. Not only in fourths, but in thirds. And he says, the way to read the heritage from Abraham to Jesus is in terms of 14-generation rhythm. It's an energy cycle which makes generations of human beings, but it has a dynamic rhythm, and the rhythm is that the first 1,000 years is 14 generations, then the next 1,000 years is 2 14 generations. It's like the set becomes distributed, whereas before it was compressed and really powerful. Now it's distributed in a sense of a ratio of 1 to 2. So that if you look at time cycles in a really large way, there are two different time frequencies in the dynamic. They're related together. And they do not follow a circle like the Romans thought. They follow a helix. So that time has a structure very recognizable as the double helix of DNA. They follow each other together, but they follow each other together in a very interesting way. They are chirally symmetrical, not dual. One curls in, the other curls out, so that the two helixes, just like the double helix in DNA, they work the opposite ways because that's the way in which they are fertile. And each one of those time cycles can generate its complement. The way to understand it is not dual, but complementarity. They go one way and the other. This is called chirality. It gives the structure of time not only an electric sense of phenomenality, but it gives it a magnetic sense of chirality. And the chirality magnetically engenders a spiritual rather than a physical reality. So that phenomena are the things of a physical reality, but spiritual forms are the noumena of a magnetic quality. And not only do they work together, but they work together as a spectrum. Just like we have an electromagnetic spectrum, which one can understand the math of perfectly well. The first maker of the realization that there's an electromagnetic spectrum was a little guy. He was about 5'4". His name was Michael Faraday. And he started out life as a janitor for a famous British scientist, Sir Humphrey Davy. He swept the floors. But he was so good at handling equipment that Sir Davies let him run some experiments, and eventually it was Michael Faraday and not Sir Humphrey Davies who found that he was a much better experimenter. And not only that, but he was a lovable little guy. And so Michael Faraday began to give public lectures in London every Friday night to the general public. No charge, anyone can come. And he was so good at this that eventually they turned over the whole lab and the whole building and everything to Michael Faraday, and he published the first work showing that electromagnetism is a real spectrum. And he wrote a beautiful little book that's still in print 200 years later called The History of a Candle, that if you can understand all of the physics of a candle, you can understand all you need. You don't have to go and get a science degree. Read my little book. Dover paperback still has it in print for a couple bucks. An old Scottish laird named James Clerk Maxwell took Faraday at his word that this not only is a real spectrum, but electromagnetism can be mathematically expressed if someone knew how to do this, and it was Maxwell who worked it out. And so the movement of time is not an electromagnetic spectrum, but is the complement to the electromagnetic spectrum. And the way to talk about it is a magnetoelectric spectrum. So that's psychic and spiritual phenomena and noumena are just as real as the physical phenomena and the noumena that we're acquainted with in this world, except that they have a much higher energy registry, about 20 billion times the frequency. So that if you were even just phenomenal in the magnetoelectric spectrum, you could walk through this universe and never touch anything, including the nucleus of an atom or the electrons or the photons or anything. You could walk through the neutrino blizzard and never feel a drop because you would be at this energy level. That's the energy level of heaven. One can pass through this universe as if it was phantom, as if it were transparent, and yet cherishing it through compassion because it is a part of the complementarity of this higher registry. We're going to take a little break and we're going to come back and we're going to see these structures, one in the west of Britain, one in the far east of India, are related together in such a way that when you come to the way in which cathedrals were first built and the baldachin with this structure was put over the altars, it is the way in which there is a rainbow arch that links the pairs of pillars together. There is a famous development in Masonic history where the sequence of the initiations was found to have an energy jump. And that energy jump, that whole series of further initiations, is called the Great Arch. But it goes back to a mythic type called the Rainbow Bridge. And the Rainbow Bridge is famous in Norse mythology because that's how one gets to Valhalla, over that Rainbow Bridge. But the original Rainbow Bridge, in the original language in which it was spoke, is called the Chinvat Bridge. And it comes from the time of Zarathustra, 4,000 years ago. And Zarathustra was a contemporary of Abraham. So that the Central Asian Aryan tradition is perfectly tuned to the esoteric Semitic tradition, and that they should have been at Holocaust odds in our time is an indication of the absolute corruption of a time form that not only was running out of energy, but running out of the space of its reality. And all of that came to an end in 1991. And the image of it goes back aeonically to Abraham's time, to Zarathustra's time. Zarathustra became a world teacher in a city that is now called Kabul, Afghanistan. Abraham was born in Ur, in southern what is today Iraq, down around where Basra is. And so Kabul and Basra, Afghanistan and Iraq, were located together 4,000 years ago, which is a double aeon. And the pivot in between is the time of Jesus. So that in order to understand why are we there in those places now, one has to be able to understand the way in which these huge rhythms of time go. And if you can, you understand that we are poised for a new age of gold very rapidly, about 2016. Let's take a break.